Thank you all for coming out today for this civil and engaging discussion on same-sex marriage. We have two important professors here today, one from our own law school and one from Brigham Young University. Before we begin, though, I just want to thank the ACLU UVA Law Chapter, Gabriel Walters and Mike Hollander, for helping us co-host this with the Federalist Society. Also want to thank Professor Kim Ford Mazuri for allowing us to associate with the Center for the Study of Race and Law. Without further ado, we're going to move into introductions for our speakers and then continue on with the discussion. Thank you all for coming out.
We have today with us Professor Lynn Wardle, who is the Bruce C. Hafen Professor of Law at the J. Reuben Clark Law School at Brigham Young University. Professor Wardle graduated from BYU in 1971 and Duke University School of Law in 1974. He then clerked for U.S. District Judge John J. Sirica, and then practiced law in Phoenix, Arizona. He then joined the faculty of Brigham Young University, where he has taught since 1978. He served as a visiting professor at a number of different law schools and universities across the world, and he's the editor of over 9 books and over 100 law review articles, chapters, and essays, most about family law, including Non-Recognition of Same-Sex Marriage, Judgments Under DOMA and the Constitution, and Is Marriage Obsolete? Marriage Relationships, Same-Sex Unions, and the Right of Intimate Associations. Professor Wardle also he's someone I've known for a couple of years, and I think perhaps one thing that tells us a lot about President Wardle and his devotion to the law and to legal academia is that both of his children have also become lawyers. And so we're very thankful that he's here with us today and look forward to his remarks. We'll now turn the time over to Gregory Olson, who will introduce Professor Ford Mazuri.
Kim Ford Mazrui is Professor of Law and Justice Thurgood Marshall, Distinguished Professor in Law at the University of Virginia. He also serves as Director of the Center for the Study of Race and Law at the University of Virginia Law School. He earned his BA in Philosophy, summa cum laude, from the University of Michigan in 1990, and his Juris Doctorate, magna cum laude, from the University of Michigan Law School in 1993. After serving a year as judicial clerk to the Honorable Cornelia Kennedy of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, he joined the law firm of Sidley & Austin in Washington, D.C., where he practiced law for 2 years. Ford Mazrui joined the law faculty of the University of Virginia in 1996, where he teaches criminal law and procedure, constitutional law, and race and law. His research interests include race and criminal procedure, race in the child placement process, affirmative action, and reparations. Ford Mazrui's publications include Ruling Out the Rule of Law, Learning Law Through the Lens of Race, Taking Conservatives Seriously, A Moral Justification for Affirmative Action and Reparations, Live and Let Love, Self-Determination in Matters of Intimacy and Identity, Interracial Intimacies, Sex, Marriage, Identity, and Adoption. That was reviewing that book. Will Affirmative Action Survive? Grutter versus Bollinger, Ask the Supreme Court, as well as Black Identity and Child Placement, The Best Interests of Black and Biracial Children. Works in progress include an examination of the constitutional implications of error profiling. And I had the opportunity to work personally with Professor Ford Mazrui my first year, my first summer, and I actually got to debate some of this stuff with him, and I know he's very civil and very passionate on these subjects. Even when I was completely wrong on stuff, he was very kind to me and treated me very nicely. And I'm very pleased to hear from him, and I'm excited to hear what he has to say.
All right, so the way this debate will be formatted is first Professor Wardle will present will give a presentation entitled What's the Harm? The Tragedy of the Commons of Same-Sex Marriage and Lesbian and Gay Adoption. And following that presentation, which will be about half an hour long, Professor Ford Mazrui will give a response for 10 minutes. Each will then have 2 minutes to respond, and then we'll open it up for a period of questions and answers for about 15 minutes. So thank you, and with that, we'll begin the presentation.
Well, thank you for coming out on a Tuesday afternoon with your busy schedules. I want to give thanks to several people, if I can figure out how to work this. I'm using my machine here and that one there. So
that's forward.
Forwards here?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me, to Aaron Cummings for extending the invitation. I've known Aaron since he was an undergraduate at BYU. To Professor Ford Mazrui for his willingness to participate in this event and provide a counterpoint. Federalist Society and American Constitution Society, make a very important contribution to legal education because they emphasize the value of having divergent points of view and presenting those points of view so that you can have a contest or conflict of opinions. And I think that's a very, very important element of our adversary system that unfortunately has been lost or diminished in this day of political correctness. Thanks to all of you for coming to listen. I want to begin with a quick audience survey because I want to know where you're coming from. You all know where I'm coming from, so help me. You've got three choices, yes, no, and undecided. Since this is a first-rate law school, I expect there will be very few undecideds. When I debated Bill Eskridge at Yale, there were no undecideds. So let's see what we have here. First is, should same-sex marriage be legalized? Yes, no, or undecided? Yes, hands up. Aaron, give me an idea of how much that is. No. And undecided. Come on, think. Okay, second, give me an idea and write it down and tell me afterwards. Second, should marriage equivalent civil unions be legalized? Marriage in all respects except the name, like Vermont, Connecticut, California, domestic partners. Yes. Hands up high. No. Undecided. Oh, golly. Third, is homosexual behavior innate? Hardwired. I was born this way. Yes. No. Undecided. I think you'll find that the answer to that and the answer to number one are almost the same. At most law schools where I've made this presentation, that's been the experience. Four, should gay and lesbians partners be allowed to adopt their partners' children? Yes. No? Undecided. There's a few more on that than on the others, I believe. That was probably 80% or 75%. Finally, should gay and lesbian couples be allowed to jointly adopt unrelated children? Yes. No. And undecided. Well, thank you. Aaron, what's the overall vote? Give us an estimate.
Well, it's about evenly divided through most of the issues, like our country, I guess. But on question, I didn't actually get a chance to see the questions. But on number four, I think that was the one where there was the most positive response for yes.
Thank you. Well, Aaron is right. We are divided as a country, and these are issues that are very important. They're ongoing. They're not merely speculative. When I started teaching family law 30 years ago and would pose the hypothetical, suppose two men wanted to marry, the students would roll their eyes and say, Professor Wardle, get real. Things have changed. It's no longer merely a speculation. This is the status of the law globally today. Five nations and one state have legalized same-sex marriage. I have an asterisk about South Africa because it's there they didn't amend the marriage law. They created a new civil union law. So it's technically a civil union. But the law says you can call it a marriage. And when the minister performs the ceremony or the government official, he can say, I pronounce you man and wife or husband and wife. So I include it because it's almost marriage. Same-sex unions are legal, equivalent to marriage, in 13 nations and 6 states. That's South Africa's the 13th. It's really 12 additional nations and 6 U.S. states. You'll notice that there are 08s by New Hampshire and Oregon. They've passed laws this year. They haven't taken effect. When they take effect, it will be 6 states. So you have seven states and a total of 17 nations where same-sex marriages have been legalized, or marriage equivalent unions. Plus you've got a number of states and seven nations that have given less than marriage equivalent benefits to same-sex couples, given them a registry and certain benefits, but not all of them. Okay. Next, on the other side, same-sex marriage is explicitly prohibited in the laws of 45 states and more than 70 nations out of 192 sovereign nations. Same-sex marriage is banned by state constitutional amendments in 27 states, and the ratio, well, I'll come to that in a moment, I believe, but the ratio of voter opposition in those 27 states averaged 69% voting against legalizing same-sex, or to ban the legalization of same-sex marriage. Same-sex marriage is banned in the national constitutions of 32 nations out of 192 sovereign nations. Examples down at the bottom: matrimony is a free union between a man and a woman. Colombia, family is formed by the decision of a man and a woman to contract matrimony. Latvia, state shall protect marriage, a union between a man and a woman. Now, why do 32 nations have this provision in the U.S. Constitution, which is the oldest constitution in the world, and it's still in effect? The trailblazer, the pathblazer, why don't we have a similar provision? Well, there are three reasons I would think of, and you could think of probably more. One is, when our Constitution was written, this wasn't an issue. When most of these constitutions have been written in the last 30 or 40 years, it has been an issue. Most constitutions respond to the problems or the threats they see to the institutions they value at the time the Constitution is written. Thus, our Constitution forbids quartering troops in homes. If we were to write the Bill of Amendments today, we might not include that. It just doesn't seem to be a major issue. But it was in 1789, and this is today for most nations. Two, we have a federalist society. A breakdown. Our government is federal, and we've reserved certain rights to the states and refused to give the federal government certain of those rights, and marriage, of course, is one of them. And so those are a couple of reasons. Let me move on. As I mentioned, the median state vote in favor was 70%. The mean state vote was 68.6%. Pretty strong grassroots opposition to same-sex marriage in most states. There are three types of state marriage amendments. Eight of the 27 marriage amendments protect only the status of marriage. Marriage is the union of a man and a woman, and nothing else. 18 state marriage amendments have a second sentence. No other relationship equivalent to marriage will be allowed in this state. And they're variously worded, but that's the gist of them. Those I call substance amendments. They protect the substance of marriage, not just the label of marriage. Marriage is, in fact, it's a, as you know, from the point of view of the law, it's a bundle of rights. And it's not just a legal title. Third, one state has a structural amendment. It says our legislature decides what marriage is. That was Hawaii. The legislature, of course, had already defined it as the union of a man and a woman. Did I forget to go forward? I'm sorry. Thank you. Federal Marriage Protection Amendment in Congress. If I do that again, let me know. I'm working with two eyes here. It passed 49-48, but that's far short of the two-thirds needed in the Senate. Likewise, it passed 55.6% in the House, but that's far short of the 67% needed. So far from passage. Although representing a majority in each case. This is simply a representation of the states that have, red states that have amendments that ban same-sex marriage. This is not quite up to date, but almost up to date. I just took this off a website. Why is there a national and even an international movement to protect marriage? One, we need to distinguish the public interest from the private interest in marriage. Marriage is a public institution. It's a public status with public benefits designed to secure for the public consequences of relationships that have very serious social effects. And it's distinguished from private relationships, private ordering, private cohabitation, private friendships. Second, there are three ways that society generally regulates relations. It prohibits some, it tolerates others, and it prefers or privileges a very small group of relationships. Marriage is the classic example of a relationship that's privileged. It's preferred because the benefits that come to society, to children, to families, and to society as a whole are so substantial that it deserves and receives, historically and in all societies, a special preference. The reason I mention that is because the claim for same-sex marriage is sometimes asserted in tolerance language. Why don't you just be tolerant? Because it's not a claim for tolerance. It's a claim for social, highest social and legal preference. Marriage is a basic social institution. It's pre-legal. The law didn't create marriage any more than it creates parents, or any more than it creates children, any more than it creates land. But it regulates land, it regulates parentage, and it regulates marriage in the public interest. It does so because the consequences are so profound. Marriage signals common understanding, which is especially important as people begin to understand what their responsibilities are, what the expectations are of these relationships in this society, particularly when there are vulnerable people whose interests are at stake. Let's move on. Marriage involves the conjugal union of a man and a woman. Historically and forever, it has. Marriage between other than a man and a woman has never been legalized in the history of the world until 2001 when the Netherlands did it, and now there are five states, if you count South Africa, international states that have done that. But it's until then, in the history of the world, you cannot find same-sex marriage. Men and women are different. The basic reason why marriage is the union of a man and a woman is because of the integration of the dramatic differences that are complementary in ways that make benefits to society that other arrangements don't match. The gender-integrating union of a man and a woman is much more valuable than the sum of merely its parts. While the union of two men or the two women may have substantial benefits in terms of their private ordering, the contributions to society simply don't compare in any respect to those made by the union of a man and a woman. Marriage is not just a Kelsenian construct. It's not just legal positivism. Whatever I choose to call marriage is marriage. It reminds me of the story told of Abraham Lincoln. He was getting heckled, and he asked his heckler, "How many tails does a calf have if you call it? How many legs does a calf have if you call a tail a leg?" And the heckler responded, "Five." And Lincoln said, "No, calf only has four legs. Calling a tail a leg doesn't make it so. Calling other relationships marriage won't give those relationships or society the benefits that we associate with and expect from marriage." I think I've already covered this one, haven't I? There are essentially two arguments for marriage, constitutional arguments that I'll review very briefly. One is, I have a right to marry. And that's the legal positivist argument. However I choose to define marriage, if I can persuade enough legislators, then I have the right to marry. In constitutional law, there are two general tests for whether there's a fundamental right, isn't there? One is, the test of deeply rooted in the history and traditions of our people, same-sex unions simply fail that test. And the second is essential to the concept of ordered liberty. Likewise, same-sex unions fail that test. Same-sex marriage has never been deemed a fundamental constitutional right. Even in Lawrence, Justice Kennedy for the court distinguished, and Justice O'Connor, in her concurring opinion, explicitly rejected the argument that same-sex marriage would be protected. I'm going to skip this. The other major argument is an equality argument, and there are two prongs of this argument. One is the Loving analogy to racial discrimination. Loving is easily distinguished because what the court said in Loving is race is irrelevant to any legitimate purpose, any legitimate state purpose the state may have to regulate marriage. Sexual behavior is not irrelevant to the purpose of regulating marriage. Some sociologists say that's the very core purpose of regulating marriage, is to control and channel sexual behavior. General Colin Powell declared, in a different context, but I think equally appropriate, skin color is a benign non-behavioral characteristic. Sexual orientation is perhaps the most profound of human behavioral characteristics. Comparison of the two is a common but invalid argument. The Supreme Court declared that white supremacy was what the anti-miscegenation laws of Virginia were about. It was to promote white supremacy. And if there's anything that's clear about the 14th Amendment, and there's a lot that's not clear given its history, but if there's one thing that's absolutely certain, it was that the amendment was designed to prohibit the government from regulating behavior on the basis of racial, the color of your skin. We have no comparable constitutional consensus regarding homosexual relations as we do regarding racial equality. Moreover, Loving supports the claim to reject same-sex marriage. Loving overturned an effort that had been very successful in Virginia and a few other states to capture marriage for the purpose of promoting a particular social movement. The movement was, in the 19th century, white supremacy. Well, actually, you can go back to the 17th century in Virginia. But in most states, it was after the Civil War. Most anti-miscegenation laws were passed after the Civil War. But the movement was white supremacy. And then in the early 20th century, it was replaced, actually the late 19th, with Darwinianism and social eugenics. You had this theory of eugenics, sort of the social hierarchy of the races. It was scientific racism, okay? That was the movement that captured marriage and redefined marriage. We will not let whites and blacks intermarry because that violates the premises of our movement. Well, today we have a similar movement attempting to capture marriage in order to promote their social agenda. And I think that their tactic is as impermissible and as dangerous to society as was the movement of the white supremacists and the social eugenicists. Another argument, the other prong of the equality argument, is gender equality. The legal requirement of one man and one woman to marry is the oldest equality rule in the law. I repeat that. It's the oldest equality rule in the law. Now, there are a lot of discrimination against women, particularly married women, in the common law in other respects. But when it came to marriage, this rule was emphatic, that one man and one woman were required equally. Two men wasn't good enough. Two women weren't good enough. Thus, I quote Justice Ginsburg, physical differences between men and women are enduring. The two sexes are not fungible. A community made up exclusively of one sex is different from a community composed of both. And of course, as applied to marriage, marriage is the foundational community of all societies. And equality in general, the issue isn't about gays or lesbians any more than it's about brothers and sisters who want to marry, or uncles and nieces who want to marry, or polygamists who want to marry, or polyamorists who want to marry, or children underage who want to marry. The issue is about the institution of marriage. That's what the debate over same-sex marriage is about. It's about an institution. It's not about you. It's about this institution. Equality does not require ignoring the profound differences between men and women that make marriage unique. And I'm going to skip over that laundry list because I come to it a little later. But first I want to now move on to the status of gay and lesbian adoptions. This is, should be of interest here in the state of Virginia because of the Miller-Jenkins case, which your Supreme Court has agreed to hear, and which involves an interstate dispute between the state of Vermont, the state of Virginia. At a more sophisticated level, it involves a dispute between two acts of Congress, the PKPA, Parental Kidnapping Prevention Act, which says states must give full faith and credit, recognition to custody decrees from other states if those states that entered those decrees had jurisdiction on grounds set forth in the PKPA. It's clear that Vermont did at the have the grounds there. The other statute is DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which says that no state has to give recognition to a judgment from another state that treats as marriage same-sex unions. The question is there a conflict between those two acts? I think there probably is not. I believe that the Court of Appeals of Virginia and the Supreme Court of Vermont probably reached the correct decision under the PKPA and that it will be vindicated. There's an outside chance that they could say that DOMA is implicated, but to do that, they'd have to find that in Vermont, the only couples that can adopt are married couples, thus allowing civil union partners to adopt is to treat those relations the same as if they were married. And if that's the case, then possibly DOMA's implicated, and being the last in time, if there's a direct conflict, DOMA would prevail. So there's a legitimate case. It's a legitimate question. But I believe that PKPA analysis is secure, and the DOMA interpretation is not quite so nearly as clear, and I believe that it will be upheld. Although I favor Virginia's policy on this issue, if you have to follow the law, and I believe we do, probably the Vermont decision will be upheld. But as I say, it's not a slam dunk. It's not a the door's not closed. It's a closer issue. 14 states in the District of Columbia do allow lesbian gay adoption either by statute or an appellate court ruling. On the other hand, 7 states do not allow all or some, most, lesbian gay adoptions by statute or appellate court rulings. The rest of the states, 29 of them, are in play. And this is an out-of-date map. It doesn't have, for instance, doesn't have Wisconsin up there. It doesn't have Alabama on it, but it shows 5 states, but it's out of date. Notice the linkage between same-sex marriage and lesbian gay adoption. Lesbian gay adoption has been cited by all the courts that have legalized same-sex marriage and civil unions, and 6 of the 7 states that have same-sex marriage and civil unions, either by court action or legislative action, have legalized lesbian gay adoption. Only 1 of the states that has adopted a state marriage amendment prohibiting by constitutional amendment same-sex marriage. How much time? Thank you. Only 1 of those 27 states has legalized same-sex marriage. So you see the linkage between gay adoption and same-sex marriage. I don't have to spell out the argument for you. If you allow us to adopt, and if one of the purposes of marriage is to protect children, then why won't you let us marry because of all the benefits that flow through marriage to the benefit of children? It's a very simple and a very straightforward and a very appealing argument. The number of lesbian gay adoptions, just cut to the quick, probably the best material on this is the 2005 Williams Institute study. They said at least 250,000 children are being raised. I said up to 317,000 children, somewhere between those two numbers, is probably the most accurate estimate that we can get, and we can only get estimates. These are based on census extrapolations. Please ignore the activist estimates, 14 million, 6 million, 4 million, 1 million. I mean, courts cite that, but as soon as they start using those numbers, you know that they're being dishonest, that they're simply trying to persuade you by the power of a number, irregardless of its veracity. The number of adoptions, the best estimate in 2000 was that there are about 6,500 children who had been adopted by gay or lesbian couples. But there's been what they call a gaby boom explosion since then, and I suspect that there are at least another 10,000 by now. Again, we don't know. We'll have to wait and see what the next census shows. International status of lesbian and gay adoption. 12 nations out of 192 allow adoption by gays and lesbians, in some cases at least, or in all cases. 10 of those are European nations, and 2 are former European nations, colonial nations. And in part of 3 other nations, Australia, Canada, and the United States, where you have federal systems, gay adoption is permitted in some parts, but not in others. So in a total, you have 15 nations where, at least in some jurisdictions in those nations, at least some adoptions by gays and lesbians are permitted. But that's less than 10% of the 192 nations. The laws vary dramatically, and that's all that that slide says, so we'll skip it. The Hague Convention on Intercountry Adoption says either the receiving state or the sending state can veto an adoption. Full disclosure is required. The Hague Convention takes no substantive position on the issue and says it's up to the states to decide. But it does let the other states refuse to recognize gay adoptions on public policy grounds, not because it is taking a position. It just says we're going to leave the issue to the states, sort of like our DOMA has done with regard to marriage. One of the big problems in international adoption now is the deception. This article by Luo and Smolin talks about a problem. There's a Colorado case decided just a year or two ago in which it was clear that the social workers, China doesn't allow children to be placed for adoptions with gays or lesbians or gay or lesbian couples. Social workers, knowing that, simply write false reports, send the reports off to justify the adoption. China allows the adoption, and then it turns out that it's a gay couple or a lesbian couple. Serious problem for international relations. Public opinion about gay and lesbian adoption. The 2003 Omnibus Survey in Europe, it's done by a Gallup associate, of 30 nations, more than 15,000 people, only four nations did a majority favor gay and lesbian adoptions being legal. 26 nations they opposed, ranging up to 87% opposition. That's Europe. Now, most of you will say, well, hold it. I thought Europe was much more progressive and permissive. They are with regard to adult sexual relations. They're much more accepting of different adult sexual relationships than most Americans are. But when it comes to children, they're very paternalistic. They believe that we need to protect children, and they're much more restrictive when it comes to adoption than we are. That was an 03 survey. In 06, the Eurobarometer done for the European Commission did a similar survey, and it found only two European nations had a majority favoring lesbian adoption. Support for lesbian adoption in 18 of the nations was 33% or less in 18 of the nations of Europe. So Europe is generally opposed to gay adoption, though they're in favor of civil unions, as you saw from the earlier list. USA, adoption remains very controversial, but the controversy is subsiding. Social science studies have been in favor of lesbian and gay adoption. Most of those studies are simply junk science. Regrettably, a good deal of it has been pumped out by a psychologist here at this distinguished university. Methodologically, the studies are flawed. They're unreliable. And even the biased studies suggest that a potential harm to children, substantially higher rate of homoerotic identification, same-sex attraction, premature sexualization, and higher rates of promiscuity at youth. Third, the best argument against these studies that say there's no difference, you've all heard about these no different studies, is Judith Stacy and Timothy Biblars, who favor gay adoption and favor gay parenting, said, every theory we have of child development leads us to believe there will be a difference. Children imitate their parents. So if their parents are engaged in a different style of sexual relationship, we think that it will affect the children as well. Now, she thinks that it will affect them positively. I am suspicious about negative concerns. Probably the biggest problem with the studies, once you get past the methodological flaws and the bias, is they fail to ask the hard questions. They fail to ask effects on a relationship. We need to ask, there's a whole lot more we need to learn about these relations that the studies simply haven't even begun to show. I would suggest realistic expectations, cutting through the stereotypes, both the positive and the negative, and look at what we'd expect lesbian gay parents to, we'd expect lesbian gay parents to do many things as well as conjugal parents. They're going to teach their children to eat. They're going to eat their vegetables, to read. They want them to be good and contributing members of society. So I don't think that we're going to see differences in many respects. But the hard question is, what about relationships? Relationships with each other, with extended family, sexual self-identification, promiscuity, relationship with extended family, and so forth. And then I've begun to do some studies. I just published one piece in which we examine the stories of children that were raised by gay and lesbian parenting. And I can summarize them by a testimony I heard given by a young woman before the legislature in Utah when they were debating an adoption restriction regarding gay parenting. Utah has a statute that says non-married couples can't adopt. Single individuals, they can. But if you're in a couple relationship, you've got to be married or you can't adopt. Because the risks to child rearing and cohabitation, whether homosexual or heterosexual, are dramatically enhanced. And I think that's the most relevant. But this young woman came and testified and said, my mom is a lesbian. I was raised in a household by two lesbian women. And I want to tell you, I love my mom, and I called her and asked her before I could come, before I testified, if she objected. And she cried and said, no, she loved me and was proud of me for having the courage to come and testify. And her testimony was, I love my mom, but that was a lousy thing to do to a child. And that's putting it in a nutshell. Now, I'm running out of time, so suffice it to say, what's the harm? The harm is the transformative effect of inclusion. That the qualities and characteristics that we associate with marriage will be transformed by the inclusion of the qualities and characteristics associated with gay and lesbian relations. Probably the best study comes from an AIDS study in the Netherlands, the most gay-friendly nation in the world. And that study found that, the average number of partners that gay men in committed partnerships had was eight partners outside of the couple every year. That the average length of those relationships was 1.5 years. This is a study that's pro-gay in the most gay-supportive nation. Other studies in Vermont show that the effect of legalizing these relations hasn't changed the effect. They studied married couples, couples that had registered civil unions, and homosexual couples that didn't have civil unions, and found that the difference between the civil union couples, that they were almost identical to the gay couples without registered civil unions, and significantly different than the couples that were married. In other words, conferring the status of the legal formal status doesn't have an effect. Well, I'm out of time, so I want to thank you for coming to hear. I hope that I've challenged you to think. I'll be happy to answer questions. And again, thank you for coming.
Greetings. Thank you all for being here, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I think it's an admirable tradition they have of inviting people to give responses, and thank you for Professor Wardle for coming to share your ideas. This is a very divisive topic. It divides families, it divides friendships, it divides communities, political organizations, it divides churches. In Virginia alone, there are churches that are splitting up over issues regarding gay rights. At the same time, it's actually not particularly divided among the social scientists. The list of nationally recognized social scientists, social studies organizations, the leading national organizations of psychiatrists, psychologists, pediatricians, social workers, find that there's no significant detriment when homosexuality is isolated as compared to other factors that may explain potentially detrimental impacts of children. There's no detrimental risk of any significance when it comes to the sexual orientation of parents. We could, of course, debate that. Professor Wardle has identified shortcomings in some of those studies. Neither of us are social scientists, however. So rather than this being a sort of battle of non-experts, I will assume, for the sake of my remarks today, that in fact these studies have not been completely conclusive on the issue, and that there may in fact be some statistics, at least if not further analyzed, that suggest some correlation between sexual orientation and some risk factors. That said, I want to think about, you know, how to come at a question that has uncertainty. A lot of this in law turns on questions of burdens of proof, turns on questions of sort of cost benefits, even if there are risks and uncertainty. How do we proceed in the face of uncertainty? Let me begin by agreeing with Professor Wardle on being pro-marriage. I think marriage is a very important institution to our society. It's important to couples, whether or not they get married, whether or not they're too old or don't want to have whether or not they have children, whether or not they're too old or choose not to. We even recognize the rights of prisoners to get married. It's helpful to couples to provide that public recognition and benefits. It's important to the children to provide the stability and financial support and public community support for those kinds of relationships. And, of course, it's therefore beneficial to society to allocate to familial units the responsibility for taking care of ourselves in a way that has external support and public legitimation. Adoption is also very important to children. One thing we're not unclear about is the importance of children having permanent parents. These statistics are also ones we're probably can't be clear on, but I believe between 100 and 200,000 children in foster care. I actually thought the numbers were a lot higher, but I tried to check, and I'm erring on the conservative side. That's many children in institutions that are going to have a high likelihood of psychological damage from not having permanent parents. There are also children in relationships with parents that have been marriages that have broken up, and it's very important to identify as best we can which parent is in the child's best interest. And so child placement and adoption among pre-existing or already existing parental relationships and formalizing them and providing support is also very important. So I wholeheartedly agree marriage and child placement are very important aspects of our society in supporting children and families. And, of course, despite the substantial benefits, we sometimes decide that those may be outweighed in particular cases where there is direct evidence of dysfunctionality on the part of a prospective or existing parent, irresponsibility, abuse. So, of course, there are certain factors that will clearly disqualify or at least disfavor in terms of the weight we give to that parent their entitlement to have custody. However, in the main, we tend not to give weight to risks that merely have large-scale societal correlations. When I'm not talking about direct evidence of particular irresponsibility on a part of parent, broader gross statistics that haven't been broken down into what are the potential causes. If we did, we would dramatically restrict access to marriage and access to child placement more than we do. Let me give you some examples. Would anyone think that veterans, we just celebrated Veterans Day, veterans should be disfavored from marrying or adopting children? How about police officers? How about white Christians? How about people who live in Utah or Arizona and profess to be Mormon? How about Baptists? How about people who live in red states? That sounds practically absurd. However, there are studies that report significantly higher rates of domestic violence among veteran families, both active duty and non-active duty, alcoholism, drunk driving, suicide, and child abuse resulting in death. Among police families, high rates of domestic violence, alcohol, suicide, and divorce rates. Among domestic terrorists, that's excluding Al-Qaeda, for example, domestic terrorists who commit hate crimes that result in murder, white Christians are the highest subgroup among that group. People who live in Utah and profess to be Mormon, and I say profess to be Mormon because the LDS mainstream church prohibits polygamy, but there are thousands of people who profess to be fundamentalist Mormons living in Utah and Arizona who engage in informal polygamous practices. There's actually reports that suggest that Baptists have higher divorce rates even than atheists, and that red states, those that predominantly go Republican, have higher rates of divorce, teen pregnancy, and out-of-wedlock births. In fact, the state, where all you know is the state that somebody comes from, if they will have the lowest risk of divorce if they come from Massachusetts. Yet, I wholeheartedly reject denying marriage or even disfavoring marriage or adoption to veterans, police officers, or any of these groups. And let me explain why I think that we don't, even though there are these statistical risks. We don't for a number of reasons. First, there are the benefits of marriage. So if we're erring on things that are uncertain, we have to remember that denying marriage and denying child placement has serious costs to society, families, and children. So that's one factor. Another factor is the risk is low. If you look at any minor group, you can see a significant risk. 5 times more domestic violence among active military than among civilian populations. But that's still low among the overall population. If you look at people who die in plane accidents, they're much more likely to be middle class than working class. In fact, if you say people who die in plane accidents who sit in the front in first class are significantly higher to be upper class. Yet we don't think that people who are middle class are more likely to die from plane accidents in a way that we should give weight to in a child placement process, because overall that's still a minuscule risk among people who happen to be middle class. So you see the point. So the risk is low. Secondly, we think that we can address the risk in more direct ways that hold people more personally accountable. We believe in personal responsibility. If people commit domestic violence or child abuse, we use the criminal law and family law to help deter those people, and we believe that it's better to go directly at those who perpetrate the irresponsible behavior than to lump them in together and treat everyone as simply a group, i.e. a veteran, i.e. a white Christian. But I think a third factor is we don't... 2 minutes? Barely started. This is my intro. Okay. Okay, I will have to... I have a paper over there that will elaborate on some of the points I make, but forgive me, I'll have to go in fairly summary fashion. But I want to get to the elephant in the room that I think perhaps political correctness, as Professor Wardle alludes to, people don't often talk about. And that is, we don't think these activities, the primary activities, are wrong. We don't think being a veteran or a police officer is wrong, or being white or Christian or Baptist, or living in Utah, or believing in Mormonism, or living in a red state for that matter. These things are not wrong. So when they combine with other low-risk, better ways of approaching it, we think, of course, we should find a more direct approach than relying on these gross statistics. But with same-sex marriage, despite the low risk, despite the dearth of any reliable evidence showing there is a risk, the best you can say is the studies are inconclusive despite showing favorable results, and despite the fact that we can have more direct ways of addressing same-sex couples, why are we being selective and saying, wait, there's statistical risks, let's wait, let's study it more, in the meantime, let's deny placement, let's deny marriage? Well, we should react differently if we think the primary conduct is wrong. If we think it's immoral, if we think, in fact, it should be criminal, as many states would do if it wasn't for Lawrence versus Texas, then of course we should be skeptical. And many people believe this to be the case. Many people that I speak to believe it's sinful. It violates religious teachings. It's immoral. It violates longstanding tradition to be in a homosexual relationship. It's harmful to children. It's unnatural. And if that sounds familiar, it should. That is exactly the arguments made against interracial relationships. If you look back at the historical record, it's almost like different species. It's unnatural. It's bestial. Represents mental defect. It violates God's law. Virginia justified it on biblical terms, interracial marriages. Massachusetts did. So it's not a north-south thing. Violated moral traditions, etc. There are many other parallels. The scope and opposition. Anti-miscegenation laws were the widest spread segregationist law than any other segregationist law. Even education segregation was justified on keeping boys and girls apart. It was the longest standing, the first to come of all segregationist laws, the last to go in Loving versus Virginia. And the most emotionally, people were more willing to say, okay, we'll let them work where we work. But the strongest opposition was interracial relationships. Similarly, you see long-standing, widespread opposition to discrimination with respect to sexual orientation, even though access to employment, etc., other contexts has fallen by the wayside. you also see the emotional reaction, what often results in lynching of Matthew Shepard, similar to the 5,000 African Americans lynched, often on accusations of interracial relationships between the late 1800s and the early 1900s. Let me skip that point in the interest of time. In child placement, I've written about this, as Gregory alluded to, it's fascinating to see the parallels. These relationships are criminal, so of course we shouldn't expose children to interracial or same-sex relationships. They'll subject the kids to societal prejudice, and that's unhealthy. And it will cause identity confusion. Kids won't know their race. They'll think they're white. The National Association of Black Social Workers said this even in the 1970s. They'll be confused about their racial identity. It will lead to all sorts of dysfunctional problems. And then similarly with same-sex relationships, there's societal prejudice, it's immoral, it's exposing them to criminal, now no longer, but only because of Lawrence's behavior, and it will perhaps lead them to be confused about their sexual identity, and perhaps even there's a greater risk that they'll become gay. You can also see parallels, racial passing versus the closet. Gaydar, where people can identify them, there's interesting historical evidence of how blacks were hired by white clubs to identify whites trying to pass. Ralph Ellison said that you can, any Negro can spot another white Negro anytime. You see in the military history of segregating by race and now history of segregating by sexual orientation, and you see the burdens throughout history placed on both kinds of relationships, including resulting in people trying to alter their identity, whether through psychiatric or religious treatments. Fred Korematsu from the internment case, who just passed away less than 2 years ago, actually underwent surgery to make him look more Western because of his race. So you see the burdens quite similar as well. And finally, in this response to the Loving point, Loving was not a case about status. It was a case about conduct. It was a criminal prosecution for the conduct of marrying someone who was of a status of a different race. It was not illegal simply to be black or be white in Virginia. It was illegal to have sexual relations with someone of a different race and marry someone of a different race. Imagine a policy in the military. You can serve in the military whether you're black or white, but not if you engage in an interracial relationship. We wouldn't say, oh, well, that's not discrimination. Even Colin Powell would condemn that. So the parallels are across the board. And so I'll conclude then with a message to two groups, which goes to the hands that went up, I suppose. For those who believe the primary conduct, that is sexual, being gay and engaging in gay romantic relationships, is morally acceptable, then I leave you to read the studies, the social science, and the others to yourselves. I think you'll see which way the weight of them lean. But read them carefully. Read the arguments by non-social scientists. But if you hold to the fact that the primary conduct is not wrong, then I think it will strike you how much the arguments seem to rely so easily on overgeneralizations, exaggerated, even if inadvertent, driven by a true moral fear, but nonetheless exaggerations of the risks involved, unsubstantiated claims, stereotypes, and again, to reiterate, I think a driving factor is fear. The other group I want to speak to and leave you with is those who believe that the primary conduct is immoral. If it's immoral, then I do understand why you would be concerned about exposing children to and publicly recognizing it. However, I would leave you with three considerations. First, I caution you to beware that even if you think it's moral and harmful other things being equal, beware that your fear and immoral concerns may lead you and people who study the issue to inadvertently exaggerate the risks and fear to children. And in the meantime, it's not costless to wait. Every day in America, children need parents, and every day in America, existing parent relationships need to be decided in child placement custody disputes in the best interests of children, and children in foster care need parents. So waiting comes at a cost. Be careful to properly give it the weight it deserves, even if you believe it deserves some unfavorable weight. The second point, consider that to the extent the arguments that you believe make it wrong resonate with the same arguments that we made for hundreds of years against interracial relationships, perhaps you're mistaken. And I encourage you to consider that and reach the point where we can look at this as we do segregation. And then third, a compromise. Hold on to your beliefs. For many of you, I know they're deeply heartfelt and born of your faith. But we also have a tradition in America of separating faith from public policy. We can have churches that refuse to recognize interracial relationships and churches that recognize them, that refuse to respect interreligious relationships. My mother had to convert to Islam to marry my father. A cousin of mine had to convert to Catholicism to get married. But other churches don't have to. But we don't, as a public policy in civil law marriage, prohibit interracial relationships or interreligious relationships. And similarly, your institution can, without embarrassment, it's your faith, you're entitled to it, refuse to publicly endorse, by public, I mean officially, in your institution, same-sex marriage. But down at the courthouse where the Constitution, not your cross, hangs, let it be equal and not with regard to factors that should be left to the private realm. One thing I respect the Federalist Society for is its skepticism of the heavy hand of government. So with respect to marriage and adoption, in that spirit, government versus private churches, let's opt for a light hand from government to maximize liberty and equality for all. Thank you.
Shall I stand here? I have much more to agree with than disagree with Professor Ford Mazrui's excellent response. If there's a difference with this, I think it would be with regard to the burden of proof. The burden of proof, I believe, lies on the parties who are proposing a radical redefinition of marriage, and also on those who are proposing a significant change in the adoption system that is really the gold standard of parenting in our country. I agree that the placement of children ought to turn on risk factors and not on stereotypes. And I think that it's important that we jettison stereotypes, not simply replace them. We seem to be jumping from a stereotype of negative gay and lesbian to positive stereotype. And I think it's important when you're talking about children to put aside stereotypes and not simply change them. Yes, there are 200,000 children in foster care available for adoption, approximately. And the question ought to be on what are the alternatives? Thank you. I think the Florida law that prohibits all adoptions by homosexuals will not stand, although the Supreme Court refused to view it and the 11th Circuit upheld it. Eventually, it'll be struck down. But a more carefully tailored law that expresses concern about risk factors associated with the gay lifestyle will be upheld because it focuses on risk factors, not on stereotypes, but on specific factors. I believe that a big concern here is intolerance, because if you shift the morality and say, we have a right to marry or we have a right to adopt, and by the way, there is no right to adopt, but that's the way the argument is posited, then those who oppose that, if you accept that as true, those who oppose it are bigots. Those who believe that marriage should be limited to the union of a man and a woman are bigots. And you end up doing things like they're doing in Massachusetts, shutting down Catholic charities, which for 100 years has placed 100 children a year for adoption. But because they won't place children with gay and lesbian couples, they're shut down. They have to withdraw from the adoption business. Same thing with the adoption.com out in California under the California UNRRA Act. Same effect. Down in Canada, That's why Mennonites are moving back to the United States from Canada, because they have their own schools, yet the schools are requiring them to indoctrinate their children about homosexual sexual relations. Because they won't do that, they're being denied teaching certificates, school certificates, having to shut down the schools. So again, I think there's much more that I agree with Professor Ford Mazrui than disagree with. I think it is a moral question. Racial marriage is simply not comparable. The best response to that, I thought, was I heard from a black minister down in Georgia who said, being black isn't a sin. Discrimination on the basis of your race discriminates on a factor unrelated to a moral consideration. And sexual relations outside of marriage are moral considerations, need to be talked about in moral terms. And I applaud Professor Ford Mazrui for emphasizing the morality. Final point, just about polygamy. I have to say, coming from Utah, you can see what we're doing to polygamists in Utah with Tom Green, 5 years for bigamy, and with Warren Jeffs, just convicted of aiding and abetting rape for the 13-year-old marriages of his polygamists. And frankly, there's more polygamy in New York City alone than there is in all of the western states together, because of the influx of people from primarily African countries bringing in the practice of polygamy. It's estimated that there are more polygamists in New York City than there are in Utah. So I think it's an issue that raises much more interesting concerns that we don't have time to go into. But I salute Professor Ford Mazrui for emphasizing that we ought to look at the burden of proof and look at the morality. Thank you.
Well, terrific. Sounds like we have some agreement. And I'd like to agree of coining a new term, and I'm borrowing part of it from you. Lesbigabies. There's got to be something like that. But anyway, some points partly responding to some of what he said in his initial remarks that I didn't have time to get to. First, here are some sort of small points. I think it's interesting to watch Massachusetts and Canada to see to what extent recognizing same-sex marriage does or does not undermine the stability and legitimacy of heterosexual marriages. With respect to Canada not protecting Mennonite discretion in their own schools, I think a tailored response to that is what we do in America with First Amendment, protecting the rights of churches in private schools to have discretion over what they teach. So we can draw finer lines. Let me also acknowledge the targeting of the polygamists. And again, that's a more targeted response. That's targeting the irresponsible behavior rather than lumping it with people who may have statistical correlations with people who have that behavior. Historical tradition is an interesting point, because tradition is something that we do value, especially at this university. You know, we're always saying it's a tradition here. And we value traditions in our religious communities and in our lives. But we have to be careful. One could go through a laundry list of traditions that are pernicious, traditions of sexism, traditions of racism, traditions of slavery. And so, in fact, Justice Clarence Thomas, who I believe is a member of the Federalist Society, wrote at length in his school case this summer that struck down race assignment in schools, criticizing Justice Breyer for defending kind of tradition over local control over school assignment. He said that's exactly what segregationists argued. If you go to the briefs in Brown, those who defended segregation said, this is our tradition. That's not to say traditions are necessarily bad either. Please don't misunderstand me. What I mean is to say tradition itself really doesn't tell you anything other than that we've been doing it a long time. And traditions of women being the property of their husband and not having the right to work outside the home, etc., those were justified in the same way. So you have to ask, well, is it a good tradition or not? It doesn't answer the question. I don't think it points one direction or the other to say it's a tradition. In fact, the UVA Alumni Magazine says changing traditions on the cover, and they sort of, it almost, there's a nostalgia for it. We used to have a tradition of first years wore hats, and people wore ties to football games, and someone streaked across the lawn the first semester. I'm glad they got rid of that one. But, you know, it's interesting, you look at the black and white picture of the guys wearing hats, the first years, there's five of them, and you look at the black and white picture of people in the stadium, they're all white men, all of them. So I'm just wary of tradition without knowing more what's the value of the tradition, and then we might as well not ask whether it's a tradition or not. Let's just evaluate it on its own terms. And then equal protection, I respect that he acknowledges it's a sin. I think that's often what's really going on in this debate, and people don't like to acknowledge the moral disagreement about this. Well, that's what, to me, makes it an equal protection violation, because equal protection says you have to treat people equally. Now, as you know from con law, or for those who haven't yet, equality is largely an empty idea. All laws discriminate, so treating people equally just means you have to have a legitimate reason to discriminate. It's not enough to just say you have to treat everyone identically. We would not have law. But if equality means anything, it must mean that the reason I'm discriminating against you is something other than because I believe you're inferior. It has to be because it's serving some purpose. It's not that I think 20-year-olds are inferior. It's you're more likely to drink and drive. That's why you can't drink. So when we draw lines, I can't drive. They don't say because blind people are inferior. That would be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause. They say it's because, I'm sorry, you'll kill people. So there's a legitimate reason, okay? Now, if the reason is because it's deep to my core that you are morally inferior, and that's what sinful means, then for that to then animate and motivate public policy is to be a per se violation of equality. It's public policy premised on the belief that the group disadvantaged is inferior. Thank you.